You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of the lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner, The Spiritual Hierarchies and the Physical World. Lecture 2 is entitled The Four Elements, Fire, and the Elemental Beings, The Lowest Realm of the Hierarchies, given on April 12th, 1909, in the evening. The knowledge that formed the basis of the teachings proclaimed by the holy rishis during the first post-Atlantean period was founded entirely upon the spiritual sources of existence. From the beginning of the post-Atlantean epoch, the most important aspect of this teaching or mode of investigation was that it penetrated deeply into natural processes and discovered the active spiritual principles underlying them. Fundamentally speaking, we are continually surrounded by spiritual happenings and beings. Physical phenomena are merely the expression of spiritual facts. Things that appear to us in material form are but the outward sheaths of spiritual beings. Thus, when the primeval divine teaching spoke of perceptible phenomena in our surroundings, particular emphasis was laid on what was, to human beings of that time, the most important natural phenomenon surrounding humanity on earth, that is, fire. Ancient spiritual science regarded the phenomenon of fire as the most important expression in nature. Spiritual research into fire comprised the central focus of all explanations of what occurred on earth. To understand these teachings concerning fire, so important in ancient times for all knowledge and life, we must first consider how other natural phenomena were regarded in the past by a teaching still valid in spiritual science today. In those ancient times, all that surrounded human beings in the physical world was referred back to the four elements. Modern materialistic science no longer acknowledges the four elements of earth, water, air, and fire. But the spiritual science of that time did not understand these as we do today. When using the word earth, they did not mean what we mean by that word today. Earth denoted a condition of matter, the solid state. Everything we refer to as solid was called earth in ancient spiritual science. It did not matter whether it was a solid lump of arable soil, a crystal, a piece of lead, or a piece of gold. Everything of a solid nature was termed earth. Everything fluid, not only water as we know it, was referred to as watery or water. Iron, for example, when melted by fire so that it became fluid, would be termed water by spiritual science. All metals in the fluid state were called water, while what we call gaseous was termed air, regardless of the particular gas to which it was applied, whether oxygen, hydrogen, or some other gas. Fire was considered the fourth element. Those of you familiar with elementary physics will recall that modern science does not regard fire as comparable with earth, water, or air. According to modern physics, fire is regarded merely as a condition of movement. For spiritual science, however, warmth, or fire, has an even finer substantiality than air. Just as earth, or solidity, can be transformed into the liquid state, so according to spiritual science, all airy or gaseous forms gradually change into the condition of fire. Fire is so rarefied that it permeates all other elements. It permeates air, thereby warming it, and the same applies to water and earth. Whereas the three other elements are separate, the fire element possesses an all-pervading quality. Now, both ancient and modern spiritual science agree that there is a still more important difference between what we term earth, water, and air, and what we call fire, or warmth. How do we get to know the earth element, or solidity? we might try touching it and experiencing its resistance. The same applies to water, though it offers less resistance. Nevertheless, we are aware of water as something external to ourselves, as a resistance. The same is true of air. We get to know it in relation to ourselves only externally. But this is not the case with warmth. Here we must emphasize an aspect that is regarded as unimportant by the modern way of looking at things. But we shall have to consider it if we wish to fathom the riddles of existence. The fact is, we become aware of warmth without touching it externally. This is the important point. Of course, we can become aware of warmth by touching an object that has been heated, in which case we become aware of it in the same way as we do the other elements. But we also feel the warmth within our own organism. That is why ancient knowledge, even in ancient India, stressed that we become aware of earth, water, and air only in the outer world, while warmth is the first element that can be apprehended both inwardly and outwardly. Warmth or fire, therefore, has a twofold nature, an external aspect, which we get to know outwardly, and an inner aspect, which we feel in our own condition of warmth. It has an inner and an outer manifestation. Actually, we feel our own inner warmth. We are hot or cold, but we are little inclined to concern ourselves with what is gaseous, watery, or solid in our organism. That is, with what is air, water, and earth in us. We begin to be aware of ourselves only in the element of warmth. Therefore, both ancient and modern spiritual science proclaim fire or warmth to be the first stage at which matter becomes soul. In other words, we can rightfully speak of an outer fire, which we perceive as we do other elements, and of an inner soul fire within us. For spiritual science, fire has always built a bridge between the outer material world and the inner soul world that can be perceived only inwardly. It was central to all observation of nature, the gateway through which we can penetrate from the outer to the inner. Fire or warmth is truly like a door. Standing before it, we can observe it from the outside, we can open it, we can behold it from within. This is how fire is to be understood in the context of natural phenomena. Outwardly, we touch a physical object and encounter fire in the same way as the other three elements stream toward us, but we perceive and experience warmth as something that also belongs to us. With fire, we stand in the doorway and enter into the soul element. This is what spiritual science proclaims about fire. In fire, we see something that plays between the elements of soul and matter. Let us consider an elementary lesson from the first human wisdom. In ancient times, a teacher of this wisdom would ask that one observe an object being consumed by fire. Then the teacher would point out that two things could be seen. In those days, one was called smoke, which still applies today, and the other was called light. Both of these natural phenomena, on the one hand light and on the other hand smoke, occur when an object is consumed by fire. A spiritual scientist saw fire as placed between light and smoke, and the teacher would say that out of the flames were born both light and smoke. Here we should keep in mind a simple yet very important characteristic of light that is born of fire. Most people asked if they see light reply that they do, of course, see light. This is absolutely false, because in fact the physical eye, EYE, cannot perceive light. Because of light, we see objects, be they solid, fluid, or gaseous. But light itself, we cannot see. Imagine all of universal space illumined by a light, the source of which is behind you, where you cannot see it. Then imagine you were to look into the world's spaces, illuminated through and through by that light. Would you see the light? You would see absolutely nothing, You would perceive something only when an object was placed within the illuminated space. We cannot see light, but only the solid, fluid, and gaseous elements that we see through the effects of the light. In truth, physical light absolutely is not seen with the physical eye. This is something that presents itself with great clarity to the spiritual eye, EYE. Spiritual science, therefore, says that light makes everything visible, but cannot itself be seen. This is an important statement. Light is imperceptible. It cannot be perceived by means of our outer senses. We can perceive what is solid, fluid, and gaseous, and we can also perceive warmth or fire outwardly. But at this point, an inner perception begins. Light, as such, can no longer be perceived externally. If you think that you see light when you look at the sun, you are quite mistaken. You see a burning body, a burning substance, emanating light. If you were to test this out, you would find that you can experience what is gaseous, fluid, or solid, and that you do not see the light, but only the burning object. So, according to spiritual science, we rise upward from earth to water, from air to fire, and then to light. That is to say, we pass from the outwardly perceptible and visible to the invisible, the spiritual etheric realm. Putting it another way, we could say that fire is on the boundary between what is outwardly perceptible and material and what is etheric spiritual, and therefore no longer perceptible. Let us consider what happens to an object consumed by fire. That is what occurs when something burns. On the one hand, light is produced. At first, warmth is generated by an externally imperceptible aspect that is active in the spiritual realm and no longer merely material. This warmth, if it is sufficiently intense, becomes a source of light. A part of this light is then given over to the invisible world, but it must be paid for in the form of smoke. That is, out of the part that was first transparent and translucent, an opaque, smoky portion is separated off. Here we see how fire or warmth is divided into two components. It portions a part of itself into light, and thus opens a way into the supersensible. But as a result, it also has to send something down into the opaque, perceptible, material world. Nothing arises in the world having only one aspect. Everything created has two forms. Therefore, on the one hand, warmth produces light, and on the other hand, it also creates opaque, dark matter. That is an ancient basic teaching of spiritual science. That is only the outer physical aspect of the process. At the foundation of the physical material process lies something essentially different. In the case of warmth that does not yet produce light, one perceives warmth as outwardly physical, but this warmth also contains a spiritual element. When the heat becomes so intense that light arises and smoke is produced, a part of the spiritual component that was in the heat goes over into smoke. The spiritual component of warmth that was in the fire and then transferred to the gaseous element, that is, into a form beneath that of warmth, is transformed in the clouded smoke. Spiritual beings connected with warmth have to allow themselves to be made opaque, so to speak, to be enchanted in the smoke. Thus everything of a clouding nature, of solidification connected with warmth, is associated with the enchantment of spiritual beings. We can put it even more simply. Let us imagine that air is made liquid, a process that can be achieved today. Now, air is mere solidified warmth, densified warmth, as a result of the smoke that has been formed. The spiritual part, which would ordinarily be in the fire, has been enchanted into smoke. Spiritual beings, which we may also call elemental beings, are enchanted in the air. And when air is transformed into the liquid state, they are even more deeply enchanted in a yet lower form of existence. That is why spiritual science sees in all physically perceptible things an element that has proceeded out of an original condition of fire or warmth. As the warmth densified into gas, it became air, smoky or gaseous. The gas became liquid, and the liquid densified into the solid state. Look backward, says the spiritual scientist. Look at any solid substance. Once it was fluid. It has only become solid in the course of development. What is liquid was once gaseous, and the gaseous state arose from the smoke that proceeded from the fire. But an enchantment of spiritual beings is connected with each stage of densification. Let us now look at the world that surrounds us. The solid stones, the streams, the evaporating water that rises as mist and fog, the air, everything solid, liquid, gaseous, and fiery, these are all, in fact, nothing but fire. Everything is fire, that is, densified fire. Gold, silver, and copper are densified fire. In the far distant past, everything was fire. Everything was born of fire. But in all forms of densification, spiritual beings lie enchanted. How are the spiritual divine beings that surround us able to produce solid matter as it exists on our planet? How do they produce liquid and airy substances? They send down elemental beings that dwell in fire and imprison them in the air, water, and earth. They are emissaries, elemental messengers of the spiritual, creative, formative beings. At first, elemental beings live in the fire, and to put it pictorially, they feel comfortable there. Then they are condemned to an existence of enchantment. We can say, as we look around us, the beings we have to thank for everything surrounding us had to descend from the fire element and are enchanted within the things of this world. But can human beings help these elemental beings in one way or another? That is the great question asked by the holy rishis. Can we release them? Yes, we can. For human actions on earth are nothing but the external expression of spiritual processes. Everything we do here is also important for the spiritual world. Consider the following. Someone stands before a crystal, a lump of gold, or the like. He or she looks at it. What happens if this person simply stares, simply looks at some object by means of the physical senses? A continual interplay arises between that person and the enchanted elemental being. What are enchanted both in matter and the human being are in some way related to one another. Let us assume, however, that our person merely stares at the object, so that he or she takes in only what is impressed upon the eye, EYE. The fact is, something is continually passing into human beings from these elemental beings, and this goes on from morning to night. As we look out into the world, hosts of elementals who were or are continually being enchanted in the processes of densification continually enter into us from our surroundings. Let us assume that as we stare at objects, we have not the slightest inclination to reflect about what we see or to let the spirit of things live in our souls. We take the easy road. We go through the world, but do not digest our experiences spiritually by means of thoughts and feelings. We remain mere spectators of the physical material world. In that case, the elemental beings enter into us and remain there. They have gained nothing in the world process and have merely transferred their seat from the outer world into us. But now let us suppose that we digest our impressions spiritually by thinking about them and by forming concepts about the underlying spiritual foundation of the world. That is, we do not merely stare at the object, but ponder its nature. We feel the beauty of things and ennoble our impressions. If we do this, what are we doing? As a result of our spiritual activity, we redeem the elemental being that streams toward us from the outer world, thus raising it to its previous state. We release the elemental being from its enchantment. Thus, through our spiritual activity, we can release beings who are enchanted in air, water, and earth, and lead them back to their former condition. Or we can imprison them again in our inner being, with no transformation having taken place in them. Throughout earthly life, elemental beings stream into human beings. To the extent that a person merely stares at the things that hold elemental beings, these beings simply enter the human being untransformed. To the extent that a person tries to work on things in the outer world through ideas, concepts, and feelings of beauty, that person redeems and frees these spiritual elemental beings. What happens to the elemental beings who have entered human beings? To begin with, they inhabit us. Even those who have been released dwell in us until we die. When we go through the gate of death, a distinction is made between those elemental beings who merely entered into us but have not been led back to the higher elements, and those who have been guided through our activity back to their earlier condition. Those who have not been transformed have gained nothing by wandering from the outer world into the human world, but the others who were transformed through human activity are able to return to their original sphere after the human being's death. During earthly life, human beings build a crossroad for elementals. After having passed through life in the spiritual world and returning through the gate of birth into a subsequent incarnation, a person is accompanied into physical existence by all the elemental beings who were not released. Those who have been released no longer accompany the person, but return to their original element. Thus we see how human beings have the capacity, in the course of their development, and in the way they establish a relationship to external nature, to free the elemental beings necessary for the creation of our earth, or to bind them even more to the earth than they were previously. What happens when someone looks at a material object and fathoms its true nature so that the elemental being is released? Spiritually, the course taken is the reverse of what occurred before. Whereas smoke originally arose from fire, the person now spiritually creates fire from smoke. At death, the fire is released. Now, in the light of this primeval divine spiritual science, we can understand the profound spiritual meaning of ancient rituals of sacrifice. Imagine a priest at the sacrificial altar in those ancient times when religion was based on true knowledge of spiritual laws. Imagine a priest kindling the flame, the smoke rising and actually becoming a sacrifice in that it is borne upward with prayers. What really happened in such sacrifices? The priest stood at the altar where the smoke was produced. There, where the solid emerged from the warmth, a spirit was enchanted. And because a human being accompanied the process with prayers, the spirit was taken into the person and was released again when the human being died and entered into the higher world. What did the disciples of the ancient wisdom say to those who were to understand such a ritual? They explained that if you look at the external world so that your spiritual activity does not remain attached to the smoke but rises spiritually to the fire element, then after death you free the enchanted spirit that dwells in the smoke. Those who had gained an understanding of the process would reply, "If the spirit that dwells in the smoke remains unchanged, it will have to accompany me in a next incarnation. After death it cannot return to the spiritual world. But if I have released it, if I have led it back to the fire, after my death it will rise into worlds of spirit and no longer need to return to earth at my birth." Here we have explained a part of the profound passage from the Bhagavad Gita spoken of in my last lecture. There is no mention of the human I, capital. The text refers rather to nature spirits, to elemental beings that enter into us from the outer world. Therefore it says, quote, "Behold the fire, behold the smoke." What we turn into fire through our spiritual activity are spirits that we liberate at our death. What we leave untransformed in the smoke remains connected with us after death and must be born when we are reborn. Unquote. Here the destiny of elemental spirits is described. Through wisdom, which we develop within ourselves, we continually liberate elemental beings when we die. But through lack of wisdom, through materialistic attachment to the world of the senses, we bind elemental spirits to us and force them into this world to be reborn with us over and over again. These elemental beings are not connected only with fire. They are emissaries of higher divine spiritual beings and are involved in everything occurring in the external perceptible world. The interplay of forces that bring about day and night, for example, could not have arisen unless hosts of elemental beings had been active in rotating the planets in the universe in the appropriate manner. Everything that happens is affected by hosts of lower and higher beings of the spiritual hierarchies. We have been speaking of the lowest order, of the messengers. Such elemental beings live in the processes that transform night into day and day into night. Again, we are closely connected with these beings of the elemental world, whose function it is to bring about day and night. When one is apathetic and lazy and lets oneself go, the human being affects those elemental beings quite differently than one does when one is creative, active, diligent, and productive. When a person is lazy, he or she becomes united with certain kinds of elemental beings, and this also happens when he or she is active, but in a most peculiar way. The elemental beings of the second class, whose lives unfold during the day and who, so to speak, tumble through the day, are in their higher element. But just as fire elementals of the first class are bound to air, water, and earth, so are certain elementals bound to darkness. Day could not be separated from night unless elementals were imprisoned in night. Human beings can enjoy daylight thanks to divine spiritual beings who have driven forth elementals and have chained them to night. These elementals continually flow into a person who is lazy, but they are left as they are. Through one's idleness, one leaves unchanged those elemental beings who are chained to darkness at night. The elemental beings who enter into us when we are active and industrious are led back into the day. We thus continually release elementals of the second class. Throughout the whole of our lives, we carry elemental beings in us who have entered us during periods of idleness and during periods of industry. As we go through the gates of death, those beings whom we have led back to the day can enter the spiritual world. Beings whom we have left in the night as a result of our apathy remain chained to us and return with us at our next incarnation. What we allow to flow into us through the mere illusion of the senses by means of outward elemental beings, what we, through laziness and apathy, allow to flow into us from the night beings, all that will be reborn with us in our next incarnation. This brings us to the second point in the passage from the Bhagavad Gita. Again, it is not the human I, capital, that is referred to in the following words, but a type of elemental being. Quote, "Behold day and night, what you redeem, what you transform from a being of night into a being of day, enters into higher worlds when you die. What you take with you as a being of the night, you condemn to accompany you in a succeeding incarnation." End quote. The implications of all this must by now be clear. That is, the same holds true of more encompassing natural phenomena, such as the 28-day rhythm that brings about the waxing and waning moon. hosts of elemental beings had to be active to bring the moon into movement, so that the moon rhythm and everything connected with it might arise visibly for us on Earth. This again meant that certain of those elementals had to be enchanted, condemned, and imprisoned by higher beings. Supersensible cognition always notices that during the time of a waxing moon, spiritual beings of a lower realm rise into a higher, but then, for order to prevail, other spiritual elemental beings must then be enchanted into lower realms. These elementals of the third kind are also connected with humanity. Human beings who are bright and cheerful, who are satisfied with life and of a cheerful disposition because of their understanding of the world, are continually liberating beings who are chained because of the waning moon. These beings enter into such people, but are continually released because of their serene soul disposition, inner contentment, and harmonious view of life. Beings who enter into us when we are sullen, peevish, completely discontented, depressed, and pessimistic, remain in the condition of enchantment in which they were at the time of the waning moon. There are human beings who, through the fact that they have achieved a harmonious feeling about the world and a cheerful disposition, work in a wonderfully liberating way on large numbers of elementals who come into being in the way described. The human being, through an harmonious perception of the world, through inner contentment with the world, frees spiritual elemental beings. Through moroseness, ill humor, and discontentment, a person imprisons elemental beings who could be freed through serenity. Thus we see that one's mood is not only of significance for oneself, but a cheerful or a morose attitude can bring about forces of liberation or of imprisonment that stream out from one's being. The effects of a person's moods stream out in all directions into the spiritual world. Here we have the third point in the important teaching of the Bhagavad Gita. Behold the one who through mood of soul releases, during the time of the waxing moon, spirits, which, when the person passes through the gateway of death, then return to higher worlds. If through ill humor and hypochondria a person leaves the spirits that had to be called into oneself for the order of the moon to be fulfilled, then these spirits remain bound to that person and must be born with him or her when the person enters a new existence. Thus we have a third kind of elemental spirits, which either are freed at the time of a person's death and return to their homeland, or which must enter this world again with the human being. There is finally a fourth kind of elemental being. These activate the course of the sun during the year and participate in bringing about the wakening, fruitful activity of the sun during the summer, so that the ripening that occurs from spring to autumn may happen. As a result, during the winter period, certain spirits must be chained, enchanted. Here, too, the human being works, as we have described, for the other degrees of spiritual beings of the elemental realm. Consider a person who says, at the approach of winter, "The nights are growing longer, the days shorter. We are approaching a time of year when the sun withdraws its ripening forces from the earth. Outwardly the sun is dying, but as this process takes place, I feel all the more the need to awaken spiritually. I must now ever more and more receive the spirit into myself." Consider a person who, with the approach of Christmas, carries an ever greater feeling of devotion in his or her heart, one who understands the true meaning of this festival, namely that when the outer perceptible world is most fully in death's grasp, the spirit must be all the more alive. Let us assume such a person lives through the winter season, and at Easter realizes that the time of sleep for the spirit is connected with the enlivening processes in nature. He or she then experiences the Easter festival with understanding. Such a person does not merely possess an external religiosity, but a religious understanding of the processes in nature and of the spirit that dwells in nature. By means of this kind of devotion, such a person is able to liberate elementals of the fourth class that continually stream in and out of the human being and are connected with the course of the sun. A person not endowed with this kind of devotion, one who denies or does not perceive the spirit, and is caught up by our materialistic chaos, is entered by elementals of the fourth class, who stream into the person, remaining as they are. At one's death, these elementals are either released or chained, so that they must reappear in the world at one's rebirth. Those who connect themselves to the winter spirits, without transforming them into summer spirits, that is, without redeeming them through their spiritual activity, condemn them to be reborn with them. If the opposite is the case, the winter spirits will not have to return with them. Quote, "Behold the fire and the smoke. If you so connect yourself with the outer world that your soul's spiritual activity is akin to the process that brings about fire and smoke, if you spiritualize the things around you through your knowledge and your feeling, then you assist spiritual elemental beings to ascend again. If you connect yourself with the smoke, you condemn them to rebirth. If you connect yourself with the day, you liberate the corresponding spirits of the day. Behold the light, behold the day, the waxing moon, the summer season of the year. If you are active in such a way that elementals are led back to the light, the day, the waxing moon, and the summer season of the year, you free those elemental beings whom you need so much. At your death they rise into the spiritual world. If you connect yourself with the smoke, staring at solid matter, or if you connect yourself to the night through apathy, to the spirits of the waning moon because of your ill humor, and to the spirits who are chained in the winter through godlessness or lack of spirituality, then you condemn elemental beings to reincarnate with you." End quote. Now we begin to understand what is really meant by this passage of the Bhagavad Gita. Whoever thinks it refers to human beings does not understand it. But whoever knows that all human life is a continual interplay between human beings and the spiritual beings that live around them, that these four groups of elemental beings are enchanted and need to be liberated, recognizes their ascension or their need to reincarnate. The mystery regarding the lowest rung of hierarchical beings has been preserved for us in this passage of the Bhagavad Gita. When one has to draw forth from primeval wisdom what is proclaimed in ancient religious documents, one begins to realize their true greatness and how wrong it is to take them superficially and thereby avoid plumbing their depths. One gains a right relation to them only when one says that no wisdom is too exalted to fathom what is contained there. Then the ancient records become permeated by the magic of devoted feelings. Only then do they become what they truly are, ennobling and purifying means for human development. Still they point to fathomless abysses of human wisdom. Only when that which springs from the occult schools and mysteries begins to stream from human beings outward to humanity at large, only then will the reflections of primeval wisdom, and they are but reflections, be seen in their true greatness and appear in their true light. By means of a comparatively difficult example, we have tonight tried to show primeval wisdom's understanding of the interplay that exists between human beings and the beings that surround and stream in and out of them. We have also tried to show something of what primeval wisdom knew of the interplay that arises between the spiritual world and the inner world as a result of human deeds. The riddle of humanity becomes important for us when we begin to realize that we influence the whole cosmos in all we do, even down to our moods, that our little world is of infinitely far-reaching importance for all that comes into being in the macrocosmos. A heightened feeling of responsibility is the finest and most important fruit that can be gained from spiritual science. It teaches us to grasp life in the truest sense, and to take it so earnestly that this life which we cast upon the stream of evolution may be meaningful. The end of Lecture 2.